to the Property Voice podcast, helping you to navigate safely through the world of property investing. Get the lowdown and updates, insights and outcomes on all matters property with a splash of entertainment along the way. The Property Voice, a voice to trust among the crowd. Now, let's get started with your host, Richard Brown.
Welcome to the Property Voice podcast. My name is Kaza and I thought I would kick off the show for you this week. I hope you are enjoying the show so far. I have had a little bit of fan mail already, so thank you so much for that. I am joined of course by the Property Voice himself, Richard Brown. How are you doing, Richard? Did you get any fan mail yet? Shall we get started?
Well, hello there, Kaza, and of course, hello there, listeners. It's very nice to be here, and yes, indeed, I'm very well. Thank you very much, Kaza, for asking. Fan mail. Does a WhatsApp message from my daughter count as fan mail? I suspect you're probably going to say not, so no need to answer that. Okay, so what have we got coming up in today's show? We've got the usual segment, so coming right up, we've got another great property topic under Property Chatter. Then we've got your voice, and this week we've got a very interesting listener question that we've got for you. And finally, a bit later on, we've got the shout out, where we share a resource that you could go to and look at. And today we've got an existing and very well known resource which is going to be applied in a very new and different way, I suspect. So check out that later on, stick around. But in the meantime, let's get started.
Okay, so let's get on with this week's featured topic with Property Chatter.
In today's Property Chatter segment, we're going to be looking at property as an investment. And let's start with a quotation from Nietzsche, who says, "He who has a why to live can bear almost any how." So last time, if you remember, we looked at the right property strategy. But today we're going to start to look at property as an investment, which is actually where I started when I first started looking at property investments seriously around about 10 years ago. For those of you who are following through my book, The Property Investor Toolkit, we're actually skipping right through to section 7 just to keep you on your toes. So last week was section 1, but this is section 7. And there's a reason for that, because most people start by trying to think of strategy when they're looking at property investments. And so that's why I started with strategy last week on last week's podcast episode. But actually, property as an investment and the fundamentals that underpin it as an investment is probably a better place to start in reality. And that's why I brought it in at this point in time, you know, quickly after the strategy section, so we can give that some proper consideration. When we're looking at investments, the average person has a few top-line investment alternatives that they can consider. So ignoring sophisticated investments for now, they can put their money into banks and building societies or some sort of savings plan. They can invest into stocks and shares, either directly or via an ISA, say. Of course, they've got pension options, and they've actually improved quite a lot recently, I have to say, with the stakeholder pension legislation, etc. So you have options for a company, a self-invested pension scheme, or the personal stakeholder types of pension which are available now. Of course, you've got property, and that's, you know, the main focus of this podcast, and you might expect me to talk about that a little bit during the course of the show today. There are, of course, one or two other ones, perhaps, you know, emerging or not so relevant in the context of this discussion. So, for example, P2P lending and crowdfunding are some emerging investment strategies that are out there right now. Of course, you've got government or corporate-backed securities like bonds and gilts. And if you're feeling very brave, then there's commodities and precious metals and such like. But fundamentally, we won't be addressing those particular investment types today. Before I go on, I really should say that I'm not qualified, and nor do I intend to give any specific financial advice. I will share the principles that I follow and obviously the investment strategies that I adopt and talk about my personal opinions in this regard. But, you know, I hope it's clear now that I'm not going to be giving anybody any specific advice. And if you want specific advice, I suggest you make contact with your own financial advisor or financial planner or something of that ilk. So to start, let's consider some of the generic principles that underline pretty much any investment before we get into the nitty-gritty of property investing. And one of the first principles to cover is the notion of risk and reward. Now, the concept goes that the higher the potential rewards, the higher the potential risks as well. So it goes without saying, really, that what we should try and do to begin with is identify as many of those risks as we can, you know, in the first place, and then take steps to either manage, reduce, or control them. Then, of course, once we have that under control, we can take decisions based on a balance between our own personal goals, our required returns, and what's known as our risk appetite. Risk appetite essentially means how much risk we can tolerate, probably before we flip or something like that. And it goes without saying that there are risks involved with every single investment, and that includes in property. It also includes government lending, because governments do on occasion go bankrupt. But quite clearly, the risk of that happening, particularly in this country, is probably low. But then again, you're probably going to find the returns are quite low as well. Once we've identified that there are risks, there's some things that we can do to try and mitigate them. And one investment principle that is often spoken about is that of diversification. And diversification, as the name suggests, is basically spreading your money around into different places. And there's quite a lot of views on this subject. Some people don't really believe in it at all and put all their eggs in one basket, but quite others, you know, suggest that you should spread far and wide across different types of individual investments, such as individual stocks and shares, across different investment types or asset classes, as they're called. So that could be property, bonds, gilts, cash, stocks and shares, of course, and indeed geographies. So not necessarily restricted to where you're located. So, for example, not just the UK, but perhaps North America, perhaps emerging economies as well. And then the other side of the coin to risk, of course, is investment returns. And returns are usually either capital returns or income returns. And there could be a mixture of both, of course, depending on the type of investment that we're looking at. Money made from buying or selling an asset would be classed as a capital return, whereas money earned through our labour or receipts from an asset, such as rental income, would be classed as an income return instead. One final point to consider under this top level section is that of taxation. Now, don't let the taxation tail wag the investment dog, is a saying I've often heard, if that makes any sense at all as an analogy. But, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, that if people try and, you know, apply their investment decisions based on taxation alone, it may end up with not the best overall outcome. At this point, I probably want to quote, though, I've just finished reading a book called The Millionaire Next Door. Now, this book is based on research over many, many years looking at millionaires in the US. Now, there's quite a lot of principles that came out of that book. It's quite eye-opening, actually, in many respects. But one of those was that how US millionaires had very low tax rates and so paid less tax as a proportion of their wealth when compared to non-millionaires. Now, does this mean that they were all a bunch of tax evaders and crooks? No, I don't think it does. I think it means that they were, you know, got themselves educated and they sought to maximize their tax position to retain more of their wealth than otherwise would have been the case. And so, too, we should look at the tax implications of our investments and at least give some thought to and planning to this exercise. As I mentioned, it might be something to do with working, you know, to walk through rather with a financial advisor. But as we are going to identify, and if you haven't, you know, sussed out already, there's lots of interdependencies when we're looking at investing, in particular property. So at this point, it might be worth recalling the words of the owner of a plumbing and heating business that I was once advising when we were talking about an acquisition and potentially structuring the agreement so that it was the most tax efficient. Very simply, he said, "If I'm paying tax, I'm making a profit, and that's good enough for me." And I've got to be honest, you've got to admire the simple logic. And it's fair to say that at times we can attempt to overcomplicate things, especially when investing and tax, and it can get very complicated. So best not to overcomplicate. Have one eye on the situation for sure. And as we get more experienced and perhaps our exposure to taxation increases, we can then look to expand our level of sophistication in that respect. So that's something of a preamble that addresses investing in general terms, regardless of the type of investment or asset class. But as this is a property podcast, you probably want to hear a little bit about property and the characteristics of what makes a good property investment and what makes it appealing. And today we're going to consider some of those key characteristics: leverage, cash on cash returns, compound growth, and inflation, and how all of these factors impact upon our investment. And I think it's appropriate to share with you the story of what I call my Eureka moment right now. So picture the scene. Round about 10 years ago, it was a fine summer's evening. The sun was shining. I think it was a Friday. I hope it was a Friday because in an early evening, I'd gone down to a local pub in the country. I bought myself a pint and sat quietly in the beer garden. Now, what I did next probably might surprise you. It's maybe not what most people would tend to do, but I actually started scribbling on a napkin or a piece of paper. I think it was a piece of paper. And what I was doing was projecting forward property prices and rental income increases over time. Now, I know that sounds a little bit sad, but if you recall or if you know, I used to work in financial services. So I did actually understand many of these principles that I'm going about, certainly in a business context, and I worked in a business-to-business environment at the time. So I was, effectively presenting these concepts to businesses, but I never really grasped it on a personal level. And this is, you know, what was happening in this particular moment. So I was scribbling away, and I think I remember getting to something like 14 properties over something like a 15 to 20 year period, and I projected forward the estimated net equity of this portfolio, and indeed the gross rental income on the same portfolio, you know, taking account of inflation and average house prices and that sort of thing. I had a financial calculator, so I had a bit of help, but this is what I did, and it was just, I was actually staggered. I was completely staggered, to be honest with you, with the magnitude of the numbers in terms of equity and net cash flow from the rental portfolio. And that is effectively what I call my Eureka moment. And my world changed right at that particular moment in time. I fondly remember, I believe the pint I was drinking was a pint of Timothy Taylor's Landlord. So maybe that was something of a sign. We'll have to see. So today, my focus is really all about investment principles in terms of wealth creation. And I will cover lots of specific investment measures and criteria in another episode. So today, what I'd really like to focus on is the whole notion of long-term wealth creation. And how do I define wealth creation? Well, for me, it would be as follows, which would be an accumulation of assets generating a passive income sufficient to fund our lifestyle expenses forever. That's it. And so there's a number of key facets which are particularly pertinent to property investment, but not exclusively so, as we'll see, that I'd like to go through, which are relevant in the context of wealth creation. And the first one of those is, in fact, leverage. Now, leverage is basically the concept of using somebody else's money to grow the size of our own investment fund. And some examples of this could be, for example, our employer making contributions into a pension scheme to match or pay in a similar amount to what we're paying. It's their money that they're putting in to match ours. So, of course, it's leverage. Similarly, the government, again, in a pension scheme or in some savings schemes, will actually make contributions to that scheme in terms of tax refunds. So effectively what they do is they give the tax back to us that we'd already paid on our income, and that gets added into the pot, and of course it grows it. And then, you know, as far as property is concerned specifically, probably what most people are familiar with is the idea of a buy-to-let mortgage. And in this particular case, a bank or a mortgage provider of some description gives us money to help us buy a property which is worth a lot more than the cash that we're going to be putting in as our own deposit. Now, another word really to describe leverage is actually multiply or multiplication. And that's possibly a better way of looking at it, even though the word leverage has become something of an industry term. And the concept is, if we take an initial investment amount and then add to this some leverage from other people's contributions, so those company pension contributions, tax credits or bank loans in the examples I gave earlier, then our returns will be multiplied by adding the two sums together. Some cases, three sums. So our returns, in fact, will be based on the total amount, even though our own cash input was on a smaller sum. So that's brilliant, really, when you think about it, isn't it? Somebody else gives us money, and we get paid a return on our own, but also that other person's money. What could be better than that? And it's certainly one of the most appealing facets of certain types of investing, and property investing in particular. So looking a little bit more closely at leverage, In reality, the value of leverage and how we calculate that is only realistically substantial through two of the investment types I mentioned above, and that's really pensions and property. ISAs, to some extent, have a small amount of leverage in the form of the tax-free element, but it's not as much as pensions and property. So I'm going to focus on this section looking mainly at pensions and property. Although, personally speaking, I actually have investments in ISAs, pensions and property as part of my overall investment strategy. And so, you know, the leveraging part is part of the reason why, as is the tax benefits in some respects as well. And going back to what I said earlier, it's an extra piece of diversification as well. But with a pension in particular, how do we calculate this thing called leverage? Well, if we're fortunate enough to be in a company pension scheme, then often what happens, and these do vary, but often what happens is that the employer will match our own contribution. It's usually not less than matched. It can sometimes be more than matched. So that obviously has the benefit of topping up our investment, you know, fund. We put money in and they top it up. Then in the government, courtesy of HMRC, gives us the tax back that we have paid over on our income, and that goes into the pot as well. So you get two lumps of leverage with a pension, which is pretty attractive. Usually, as I say, the employer would match. So if we just take a real example, if we paid something of the order of £2,000 each year into a company pension, then the employer is going to match that contribution in the illustration I'm giving by up to the tune of another £2,000. Then, of course, the tax man gives us a nice boost by putting in the tax that we would have otherwise left with them back into the pension fund. It's an incentive, obviously, to maintain a pension. Of course, that tax credit is based on our personal contribution and not on the company's contribution, as far as we're concerned anyway. And so that £2,000 annual contribution to the company pension scheme in this example would have actually swollen to £4,400 as a basic rate taxpayer. Now, it will actually be higher if you're a higher rate taxpayer, but just to keep things a little bit simple with all the numbers on a podcast, I'm not going to share all that information for higher rate taxpayers and the highest rate taxpayers here. So if I just keep it for basic rate taxpayers for now, hopefully you understand. Now, here's the key. The investments that I've just been talking about, £2,000 was how much we put in, and we ended up with £4,400 actually being invested into our fund. So the leverage factor here is 2.2. So it's one divided by the other, just to get the maths correct. 4,400 divided by 2,000, just to get the maths clear. So another way of considering this is just to look at it that our investment has grown by at least 2.2 times in this example. And so the returns that we're going to get on that pension are based on the total fund of £4,400 in this example, not just the 2,000. And I think that's pretty cool, to be quite honest with you. I'm not against pensions whatsoever. However, let's look at the situation with regard to property. Now, property is a little bit different. The government doesn't usually like to give us too much in the way of tax credits to the initial fund, at least, although there are certain tax breaks in different ways. But with property, the biggest element of leverage really comes through borrowing money for a mortgage or something similar to that. And so if we had, for example, an investment fund of, say, £20,000, then we could leverage this up to, say, £80,000, by using bank lending with a 75% mortgage. We put in 20, they put in 60, then we can buy a house worth 80. So in this particular example, the leverage factor that I mentioned is actually 4. And if you remember with the pension, it was 2.2. So the bigger the number, the more the leverage in round terms. And again, putting it a different way, our investment fund has grown at least 4 times to what we started with, and we achieve gross returns based on the highest figure of this total investment. And again, it's not just restricted to our total contribution. So if pensions was cool at 2.2, then I would say property is even cooler at 4, if I can get my math straight. One word of caution, though, in this example, is that, as I mentioned, with a property, we've actually taken on a mortgage. Now, it wouldn't be, you know, wise for me just to leave it at that. We do, of course, usually have to pay interest on that mortgage. I don't know too many lenders generous enough to let us have the money without paying interest. And so in reality, I mentioned the word gross returns earlier. In reality, our returns will be reduced down by the interest that we have to pay back to the lender. But I have a golden rule here, which is something I keep in mind whenever I'm looking at this, and that's to make sure that the total returns on my property investment as a percentage are higher than the lender interest rate that I'm taking on. So for example, if I got a gross rent of 7% and my mortgage lending rate was 5%, then that broadly meets my golden rule. It's a little bit more complex and sophisticated than that, but that's just something to, you know, keep in mind when we're working with this type of thing. Of course, if we're in a situation of high interest rates and maybe rents were squeezed a bit, which has happened occasionally, sometimes if there's a time lag, then we could find ourselves with a what's called a negative geared investment, where leverage works against us rather than with us. But that doesn't happen too often because, as I mentioned, there's usually a lag, and rents will often increase eventually to catch up with interest rate rises. So really, if I could summarize what leverage really is, it's the concept of using other people's money to help us grow our investment return. And if we can remember this concept and start to think how best to apply it, then it's really going to help with our investing. The next concept I'd really like to share with you is that of cash on cash return. And this is actually the money that we make on our physical cash invested as a proportion of our total investment fund. It's the return, the gross return on the fund as a percentage of the actual cash we've invested. And that's another brilliant concept. And the reason is that we're actually making money off other people's money to grow our own returns. So if we take some examples looking at the pension and property that we've already looked at, if our pension fund was to achieve an annual investment return, which is typically through dividend income of around 3.5%, and that's actually an average that's been shared by the Motley Fool, then our pension contributions we shared earlier would generate around about £154 per year in return. And if we remember, we put in £2,000, so our cash on cash return in that case would be 7.7%. And this is how leverage increases our cash on cash returns. So instead of a 3.5% return, we've actually managed to grow that to 7.7 using what's called the leverage factor. Now, if we look at the same concept with property, and if we achieve something like a 5.3% return based on the UK's average rental income, which is highlighted by Kate Faulkner, for example, then actually our return would generate, in the previous example, of £4,240 a year based on our £20,000 investment pot. So here, and it's fair, I'm not comparing the pound notes to the pound notes because I use different figures, so it's best to look at the percentages. So in this example, we've actually managed to turn a return into 9.2%. Again, taking our actual cash invested, in this case it was £20,000, and so our cash on cash return would in fact be 9.2% after allowing for a mortgage interest payment of around about 4%. Now, in both investments, there are additional costs to take into consideration. So this analysis is actually simplified just to illustrate the point, and you shouldn't rely on it just in this, but it's just to get the point over in the context of this podcast. So far, I've only really been talking about income returns, so dividends on stocks and shares or rental income on property. But actually, that's only part of the equation in both cases, because share prices can change, which would give rise to a capital growth, probably, if it goes up. And same with property. So this whole principle of cash on cash returns and leverage applies equally to capital growth as it does with rental returns. And if we look at the FTSE 100, that's averaged something like a 5.3% annual growth rate over the last 20 years, whereas house prices have averaged around about 7.1% over a similar point in time. Now, it's dangerous to sometimes compare over time periods, because if I'd have gone 15 years, it might be different. If I go 30 years, it may be different. But it's just to give you an idea. But even if we assume the same growth rate of 5.3%, one of the figures I just quoted in each case, the cash on cash returns would be 11.7% for a pension or 21.2% for property, just by applying the whole concept of leverage. So hopefully we're starting to recognize how the concept of leverage, when compared with cash on cash returns, makes it for a very compelling investment case. The next investment principle that I really wanted to highlight was that of compound growth. Now, compound growth, according to Einstein, was the eighth wonder of the world. And he goes on to say that those understand it earn it, and those who do not pay it. And in very simple terms, compound growth is interest added to interest. So to take a simple example, if we had a £10,000 investment and the interest rate was 3%, then after a year, we'd earn £300. Now, that's what's called simple interest, the 3% on the £10,000. So rather than in with the example of compound growth, the figures change a little bit because we earn interest on the interest. And so in the second year, instead of it being £300 again, which of course is the 3% on the 10,000, we actually earn 3% on the £10,300. So our second year interest in this example would in fact be £309. Now you may think, wow, £9. It's not exactly an awful lot, is it? But that's the £9 is the compound interest effect that we've had, earning interest on top of interest. As I said, it doesn't sound like a lot, but if we project that forward for something like 25 years, which is the typical mortgage term that we might be entering into, that same £10,000 starting fund would have grown to a whopping £20,938, which is a 209% return. Now, I did the maths, and if you'd have just had the simple interest, i.e. those £300 each year, we would have ended up with £17,500 instead, or 175% increase. So all of those little £9, which of course grow as time goes by, is what's called compounding. And that 34% extra is the total value gained purely by compound interest. And that is really impressive. Just a quick word really about inflation. Now, what is inflation? It's really a reflection of the purchasing power of money over time. So some people say in real terms. And it is in fact another form of compounding, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. Suffice to say that inflation can either increase or decrease the value of our money depending on whether it's an appreciating asset or not. And the key concept here is inflation can work with us with an investment. So house prices, for example, are a form of inflation. So they will typically, over time, go up in value, and that adds to our investment value. And similarly, they can work with us to erode the value of our debt. So if we have £100,000 worth of debt, over a 25-year period, the effects of inflation will reduce that down very significantly, perhaps even half or less. So inflation is another concept to keep in mind, and it can actually be our friend as long as we don't, you know, abuse the fact. So as I mentioned at the start of this episode, what I'm really looking at here today is wealth creation. This is my focus, and property specifically as an aid to building an asset-based portfolio that generates this passive income to fund our lifestyle forever, my definition of wealth creation. So what are the steps that we can take, you know, to go forward with the information that we have now? Well, the first one I usually recommend is to determine what I call the number. Now, I've written about this over at the blog, so there's an article which sets this out. But essentially what it is, the number is a sum of money that if we were to take an income from over time would actually generate the income that we need without running out as time goes by. There's something called the safe withdrawal rate. And the safe withdrawal rate basically boils down to a simple mathematical formula. And the way I like to reflect this is that the number is quantified as being our total annual lifestyle expenses times 25. And that really flips around that the safe withdrawal rate, which seems to be recommended by a number of analysts, is 4% a year. Now, couldn't you withdraw 4%, more than 4% a year and actually have an enjoyable lifestyle and not run out of money? On occasions you can, but that's why it's called a safe withdrawal limit. So 4% is comfortable, and that can satisfy our lifestyle aims probably. So if we had annual living expenses of £20,000 as an example, using this formula times by 25, we'd actually need £500,000 in terms of an investment fund. So hopefully that makes it clear. But of course, the number needs to take account of all our income. So, you know, state pensions and company pensions, that sort of thing can come off. So we don't necessarily have to generate all of this money through our personal investments. Step two is to determine when we're going to need this money. And this could be our normal retirement date or even an earlier or later one, depending on what our plans are for working once we get to that stage of life. And this might actually identify a gap, because we'll have a number that we've quantified based on the first step, and then we'll have a timeline which we've determined from our second step. So the next logical thing to do, of course, is to set some targets and to make a plan of how we're going to get there and achieve the objective that we want to. Now, with a standard buy-to-let, we're usually going to have to save some money for a deposit and costs and fees and this sort of thing. So it's probably we're going to need something of the order of 30% of the purchase price in reality. And so this is obviously going to need a committed savings plan and some strict budgeting. And I definitely encourage this to happen in any case. But as I mentioned in the first, in the last episode, there are strategies out there which don't require as much money, or even in some cases any money at all. And that's what that's why it's called the right property strategy. So it might actually be the case that we can do this without quite the same amount of money as we imagined. So really, this all points to, it's all about the why, the reason why. And I'm going to go back to the quotation I began the episode with from Nietzsche, who said, as I remind you, "He who has a why to live can bear almost any how." So it doesn't really matter about the how, it really matters about the why. And if the how is the strategy, the why is the purpose. So what is it we want to invest in, you know, to achieve at all? It could be to have a pension or supplement a pension. It could be to retire early. It could be to replace a job income, for example, pay off some debts, leave an inheritance or give some money to charity, help family members, travel the world and support other good causes. There's lots of reasons why, or a purpose, if you like. Then, of course, in the previous exercise, we've determined the what, which is the number that we want to achieve and the timeline that we want to achieve it in. And then after we've done that, we can set about looking at the how, which is our strategy, the purpose of the last episode, if you remember. Now, things are likely to change as we go, but we'll never get to where we want unless we start, even if we end up by taking a different route. So by understanding and applying the principles of leverage, cash on cash returns, compound growth and inflation, we can start to see how these have a bearing on investments in general and on property investment in particular. Add to this our understanding of our purpose for investing, or our reason why, our what and our how, and you can start to build a little strategy and a plan of going forward. This way, we're going to be better equipped to look at the strategy and our long-term wealth creation plans and take appropriate action. So tell me, have you had your eureka moment yet? If so, I'd really love to hear about it. Please get in touch either by email or drop a comment in the show notes over on the website.
Up next is Your Voice. It's all about you and your property world.
Richard, we have a very interesting listener question for you this week. I won't mention his name, but the question is this. Did you have a mentor when you started investing in property yourself, Richard?
Yes, thank you, Kaza. I think that is a really interesting question, in actual fact. And my answer to that really is, it depends on how you define what a mentor is. Now, most people start thinking of a mentor as an actual person, a physical person. So that could be an experienced investor who's there to help you, lead the way for you, guide you, give you confidence, challenge you and support you. And that's often the case. And people often start with that kind of mentor. But early on, we could, in fact, gain some insights through other types of learning. It could be through books and forums and blogs and that type of thing. It could be attending online and offline networking meetings and asking other investors their opinions. It could also be through forums and that type of thing, through getting inputs and opinions onto specific issues that we've seen, or indeed watching the posts of other experienced investors and learning in that way. I have to say that over the years, I've had business, property, and personal mentors and such like, and I continue to build those mentoring relationships today. Ironically, though, when I started investing in property, I adopted something of a virtual mentoring approach, and by this, what I mean is, I myself went on these forums and read a lot of books and that kind of thing, and it was a little while later before I actually got my own property mentor. Now, I've had, as I mentioned, business mentors and personal mentors in the past, but it took a little time before I ventured into the property mentoring field. I would say this, though, about mentoring, and the statistics I'm about to quote come from a Business Insider article, which we'll quote in the show notes. And it says these two things, essentially. First of all, it says that mentors aren't for everyone, and I think that's the personal, physical variety, a real person, in other words. And it cites something like 24% of the rich, which is quoted in the article, have a mentor. But for those that, the second point, for those that do have a mentor, a staggering 93% of those attributed their wealth to their mentor. So I guess the conclusion from that is that mentors are not for everyone, certainly not the individual mentor. It's not necessarily for everyone. But when it is for you, I think the results and the difference in your life can be absolutely staggering. And that's the main takeaway I found from this piece of information. And I myself have got mentors, and I'm quite happy with the progress I'm making.
And now, where you can go for more great resources with the shout out.
In the shout-out segment of the show, what we're really trying to do is share tools, tips, and resources that perhaps you might not be that familiar with, just to aid you in your own property journey. So in that respect, today's shout-out might just surprise you a little bit. Would you like to share it with us then, Kazza?
Yes, Richard. I was a little surprised to hear about this myself. In technology terms, YouTube is like a grandfather to me, as you know. However, I recently discovered that you can actually listen to books on YouTube now. I know that you have experienced this recently yourself, Richard, so perhaps you could elaborate a little more.
Yes, Kazza, YouTube has a range of books and other audio content that we can listen to freely to further develop our knowledge. I recently listened to the Think and Grow Rich audio from Napoleon Hill again. I must admit, I heard it about 20 odd years ago, so it wasn't a bridge version that I listened to this time. But it was great to have it on in the background whilst I was doing some admin tasks and soak up some information whilst I was doing so. So there you go, YouTube is today's shout out. That's it then. That wraps up another week on the Property Voice podcast. I hope you really did enjoy the show. Don't forget to check out the show notes and get involved in the discussion over at thepropertyvoice.net. And please don't forget to send us in your voice contributions either. Until next time on the Property Voice podcast, ciao, ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
Thank you for listening today. Now head over to thepropertyvoice.net for more inspirational content and get updates through our mailing list. Join us next time on the Property Voice podcast. And if you enjoyed the show, please don't forget to rate us on iTunes.